Sometimes, out of the heavens, the great gods will drop something unexpectedly into our laps. It's their way, I suppose, of saying, "Thank you for your custom. Thank you for believing in us." It is their way of throwing us a bone. The only word that can adequately describe our feelings when this happens is thrill, which ought to be spelled with a couple of Z's instead of L's, since it has the same effect as sticking your finger into an electrical receptacle. I put the scrap on the desk and reached into my pocket, smoothing as I pulled out the piece of paper I had found in Orlando's pocket. 54, 6, 7, 8, 9, I read. Same ink, same written numerals as those in Mr. Nightingale's ledger. I pushed the two torn edges of the papers together. It was a perfect fit. I pocketed both pieces. Well done, Flavia, I thought. There was a step and a stair behind me, and as I whirled, something rough was clapped over my face, covering my nose, my mouth, my nostrils. I was filled instantly with a sickeningly sweet, stinging, and pervasive odor, which I recognized at once as diethyl ether. Oddly enough, I even managed to remember the chemical formula of the stuff, C2H5-2O, and the fact that it could be obtained by distilling a mixture of ethanol, common drinking alcohol, and sulfuric acid. I struggled to break free, but it was no use. Whoever had seized me was stronger than I was. I clawed at the wrists that were pressing against both sides of my neck, realizing, even as I did so, that it was a lost cause. Carried by the breath, diethyl ether, like those poisonous clouds in a cheap thriller film, swells up the nose and goes directly for the brain. There is nothing subtle about the stuff. Its smell is so powerful that the odor of a single drop can fill a room. And I remembered reading somewhere that a cat would refuse to eat the flesh of an etherized rabbit even after it had been boiled. I knew that there were just a few seconds left before I lost consciousness, the telltale buzzing in my ears, like a swarm of invisible insects, had already begun. Half in a haze, I felt myself being lifted bodily in someone's arms, lugged across a crazily spinning room, and dumped heavily, like a bag of bones, into what looked, to my burning, bulging eyes, like a large wooden box. That, and then something that seemed to sound like coffin screws biting into wood. On the one hand, it was the most terrifying thing that had ever happened to me in my entire life. And yet, on the other, the most strangely satisfying. Here I am at last, I thought. Now I know what it is actually like. It was, in one sense, as if I had crossed some mystic finish line and had come home at last in a blaze of great glory. But yet in another, as if I were back at the beginning, tensed, waiting for the starter's pistol, about to die, yet about to be born again. What would I be, I wondered, if it turned out there really was such a thing as incarnation? A dweller in a grass hut, perhaps, like one of those carefree tribal beauties I had seen in the cinema travel films, whose only desire in life was to pull the most frightening faces for the white man's camera? Or a slave, perhaps, in ancient Egypt, milling corn on a slab for the flatbread which would feed the hordes of sweating slaves who were hauling stones to build the pyramids? But perhaps not. The world was changing, and I, whatever I was changing with it. By the time I came around again, I might well be a famous scientist, a chemist, of course, calibrating the controls of some new and as yet undreamt of device, which would permit me to peer into the most secret heart of the universe. But first, I had to suppress the feeling of panic that was rising in my chest. I fought frantically to swim to the surface of my senses. The first of these to return was memory. It is a fact that oxygen deprivation begins damaging the brain after less than 5 minutes. I had learned this by studying the notebooks of my late Uncle Tarquin, who had participated in several experiments with John Scott Haldane, the renowned Scottish physiologist. Haldane had famously sealed himself inside specially constructed glass chambers in order to observe, firsthand, the effects of certain gases, including ether, upon his own brain. Haldane had come to the conclusion that lack of oxygen does not stop the machinery, meaning the brain, but destroys the whole apparatus. I also remembered, although rather vaguely, that Haldane had analyzed the air in the sewers beneath the House of Commons. It was not easy, though, to think. The ether was making it difficult to distinguish between thought and reality. Was Haldane a thought, or was he one of the faces that was now rushing toward me through a swirling tunnel at the speed of the Flying Scotsman? Because my body failed to respond, I couldn't leap out of the way. Was I moving sideways, or merely thinking about moving sideways? There was no way of knowing. I felt oddly like Alice, falling endlessly, endlessly falling, floating, rocking from side to side like an autumn leaf, down the rabbit hole, but with nothing to grab, no cupboards or bookshelves, no jars of marmalade to seize. Now I was becoming aware of a stinging tingle around my mouth and nose, as if the middle of my face had been held too close to a campfire. Diethyl ether does that, I found myself thinking idly, as if someone else were thinking my thoughts. It irritates the skin. I forced open my burning eyes, but could see nothing. Nothing but total darkness. Have I been struck blind? I remember wondering idly, as if it didn't matter. Consciousness must have been returning by then, although I didn't think that at the time. I am in a box, is what I thought in actuality. A coffin. For an instant, the odor of pine overwhelmed the chemical smell of ether. But what are its dimensions? How much air is available, and how long will it last? The standard coffin, I remembered, measured about 5.5 feet by 2 by 1.5, which made a little over 16 cubic feet, if my woozy mind was any judge. Minus, of course, the volume of my own body, which was roughly half that of the coffin. I didn't actually work this out in my misfiring brain, but it made sense that the size of any container is proportional in some way to its intended contents, except in the case of breakfast cereal, of course. If the average person breathes, say, 7 liters of air per minute, that would work out to about half an hour's oxygen remaining. I must not panic. I must breathe slowly, shallowly, evenly, regularly. I must feed my brain without wasting oxygen on useless muscle movement. This is easier said than done when the mind is already flying ahead to vivid images of a black and desiccated corpse being dug up in some remote forest, its features frozen in horror, its fingers worn to stubs by frantic, fruitless clawing at the lid. No point in pounding at the wood or screaming out my burning lungs. My attacker, whoever he or she might be, was still in the room, and would be the only person on earth who could possibly hear my cries for help. Besides, I thought, if I made too much noise, they might well decide to take certain other steps to speed my death. Although I didn't want to dwell on this idea, I have to admit that fire or water crossed my mind. A person locked in a wooden box is a sitting duck, so to speak, to flame and flood. Better to keep quiet. Better to play dead. I winced as the inevitable ether headache wrapped a rope around my temples. I had read about this effect, of course, but this was the first time I had ever experienced it. How fortunate I was not to be suffering that other complaint which ether often causes, gut-wrenching vomiting. At the moment, in spite of the danger of the situation, I could think of nothing worse than to be locked in an airless box filled with my own stomach contents. I reached up slowly, tentatively, with my fingertips. As I had known it would be, feared it would be, the lid was right there, inches above my face. "Don't dwell on claustrophobia," a voice said quite clearly from somewhere close by. Or was it in my head? My wits were beginning to return. Although there was still the stink of ether inside the coffin, it was not nearly so noticeable, or so I thought, as it had been. As a scientist, I knew that things must be dealt with in logical order. A helter-skelter chain of thoughts would result in my death. It was as simple as that. The first requirement was oxygen. Without it, there would be no second requirement. I focused upon oxygen and how to get it. A breathing hole would solve the problem. Even a tiny one could be breathed through in a pinch. All that was needed was some small metallic tool to work through the wood. Unfortunately, I had refused to wear my braces on this summer holiday. "Put them in your pocket, dear," Mrs. Mullet had insisted. "You can wear 'em at night in bed when no one's looking." But I had sauced her dreadfully, and how I regretted it now. I wiped away a tear which, I realized, hadn't been caused by the ether. I took silent inventory. No braces, no hairpins, no pens. Even my little silver crucifix, with its concealed magnifying glass and switchblade knife, had been left at home through my own stupid fault. If ever I escaped this predicament, I decided, I was going to acquire a lady's handbag with a toolkit that would cause any burglar to drool with envy. I would never, in future, go anywhere without it. Not even to the WC. No wonder women lugged all that stuff around on their shoulders. It was necessity, not vanity, that determined what you carried in your kit. But wait! What about the crochet hooks in my pocket? I had almost forgotten them. Taking care not to exert myself, "Keep calm, Flavia," I worked one hand slowly into my pocket. My fingers touched the L-shaped hook. Slowly, gingerly, I extracted it, and anchoring its business end against the side of the coffin, began a twisting motion. After only a few minutes, my fingertips were throbbing. The awkwardly shaped hook was going nowhere. The varnish was too hard, the coffin wood too thick. As I had noticed earlier, this was a well-made coffin, too well-made for my liking. I mentally cursed Mr. Nightingale for various reasons, and as I did so, the crochet hook snapped in half. "Son of a sea cook!" Although each half now had a sharper end than before, they were both too short to get a decent grip on. I reached for the second hook. Perhaps the sides of the coffin were thinner. Lids and bottoms would be the thickest because, well, we wouldn't want any unpleasant accidents during funerals, would we? I shifted myself to one side and resumed my drilling motion, but I soon realized it was in vain. The hook was slipping in my sweating hands. I was breathing too rapidly. How stifling it was in the coffin, and how heavy my lungs had suddenly become. No point in using up whatever remained of the oxygen. How much time remained? 20 minutes? Less, perhaps, because of my exertions? Time to face reality. It was now quite clear that if rescue were to come, it would come from the outside. I had exhausted my resources. I shifted my head slightly, first to the right and then to the left, pressing my ear softly against one side of the coffin and then the other. As I knew from years of listening at doors, an ear to a wooden panel amplifies the slightest sound remarkably. If anyone else was in the room, I would certainly hear them. Thank heavens, I thought, that my attacker had chosen a coffin which had not yet been lined with decorative padding of muffling silk or satin. Even a single layer of fabric, such as curtains, for example, can be frustrating to an eavesdropper. But outside the coffin, the room sounded as silent as a tomb. A breath caught in my throat as I tried to ration the air. All right, I admit it. I wanted to weep for myself. I wanted to explode with fury. Surely I was entitled to that. A little display of fireworks to celebrate my entry into the afterlife. Even a condemned killer was entitled to a Last Supper, as pointless as it may seem. To the best of my knowledge, no one had ever died from going hungry to the gallows. Which turned my mind back to Canon Whitbread. What had his last meal consisted of? Had he ordered up a banquet of roast beef with all the trimmings, or had he humbly settled for Holy Communion, and gone to the grave with the taste of sacramental wine on his lips, as had his victims, the Three Graces? Suddenly, everything began to fall into place. I remembered Daffy once reading aloud from Boswell's Life of Dr. Samuel Johnson, in which that ancient bore had said, "Depend upon it, sir, when a man knows he is to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully." Although I had at the time thought this the most awful load of rubbish, it turned out to be true after all. The prospect of my own immediate death washed windows in my mind, which must have become clouded over with the scum of my own accumulated pig-headedness. At that very instant, I made a solemn vow. Should I survive this day, I would never, ever scoff at anything or anyone again. And, by all that's holy, it worked. Suddenly, just as the good Dr. Johnson had said it would, the darkness had lifted and my mind was sparkling with remarkable clarity. It could not possibly be due to the ether, which is known, in fact, to have quite the opposite effect. My spirits rose. I would go out in a blaze of glory. Hang the exhausted air in the coffin. I might be dying, but I would die a Deluce. I would die defiant. How proud of me my mother Harriet would have been. How proud my father also. In a very few moments now, I would be rejoining them. Farewell, chemistry, I thought. Besides my parents, I would also be greeted by some of the greatest chemical minds of all time. Humphrey Davy, Henry Cavendish, Edward Franklin, Ernest Rutherford. How proud I was of my country. Die I might, but I would die British. How exhilarating that decision was. I lay rigidly at attention, my arms straight down at my sides, and began to sing, "God save our gracious King, long live our noble King, God save the King." Although King George the VI, my dear and beloved old friend, had died 4 months ago, his daughter, Princess Elizabeth, had not yet been crowned queen. But she would be. Oh, yes, she would be. Before my bleached bones had settled into the English soil, Queen Elizabeth II would be seated on the throne, and the world would be fresh again. And now I was bellowing the words, the tears springing hot to my eyes. "Send her victorious, happy and glorious, long to reign over us, God save the Queen." Now only darkness and death remained. I awaited them, my head held as high as I could manage. Someone was hammering. 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 I wished they would put an end to it and leave me in peace. "Go away!" I wanted to shout, but my tongue was dry and swollen in my mouth. Then came the nauseating grinding sound of protesting wood. I tried to wet my lips, but there was no moisture left. In the darkness, I was being jerked and jolted like shot game in a hunter's bag. "Stop it," I thought, since I couldn't form the words. A sudden blaze of light caused me, in spite of my weakness, to throw up my boneless hands defensively in front of my face. Someone was wrapping their arms around me. I struggled to fight them off, but it was no use. My entire body was an unpleasant, reeking jelly. "Flavia," said a voice, and I tried with all my strength to force one eye open against the stabbing pain of the light. Again, "Flavia," more insistent this time. As things swam into focus, I saw a face looming above me, a huge, round face, its features grossly distorted as if viewed through a fishbowl. It couldn't be. It was impossible. "Flavia," Dieter said as I threw up on his cashmere jumper. Pity was my only thought. It was such a beautiful robin's egg blue. "Sorry," I mumbled as he lowered me gently to the floor and propped me against the wall. I looked wobbly-eyed round the room in amazement. Feely was bending over the prostrate Mr. Nightingale with a rubber mallet clutched like a cricket bat in her hands, and from the rising red welt on the back of the undertaker's neck, I knew that she had recently used it. The poor man wouldn't have stood a chance against Feely's anger. "How dare you manhandle my sister!" she shouted, seizing the man by the collar and giving him a shake that would have loosened a monkey in a tree. "How dare you attack my fiancé?" Nightingale seemed not to be hearing her. "How?" I asked weakly, waving one of my flippers at the open coffin. "Did Dogger send you?" "We were outside in the courtyard," Dieter said, colouring slightly, highlighting the fresh abrasion on his chin. "Feely and I, behind the coffin cases. We wished to, you know, to be alone. We thought no one would ever—" "Dieter!" Feely snapped, her cheeks like Mary Poppins. "That's enough!" In spite of the risk to his life, Dieter shot me a secret wink. I wiped off my mouth and did my best to grin. "Ring up Dogger and have him bring the rolls around," Feely said, pointing to the telephone on the desk. "Then call the police. They'll know what to do with him." "Don't count on it," I managed to say. The rest of that evening is best left to the imagination, except to say that mops and buckets played a prominent part. Who would have believed that a girl could sleep so much in June? Chapter 25. I had been up since long before the sun. The sickly sweet effects of the ether had still not worn off completely, and my stomach felt like a sea-going barge. We were going home today, but before we left, I had several things to do, one of which was to telephone Inspector Hewitt. I agonized about how best to manage this. I had covered a sheet of paper with scrawled notes, with headings such as "Opening Pleasantries" through "Topics for Discussion," all the way down to "Thanks and Closing Remarks." But what if the inspector didn't want to talk to me? What if he decided that unsolved murders were not a permissible topic for discussion with a member of the public? I would simply have to take my chances. The worst the inspector could do, I suppose, would be to tear a strip off me and hang up in my ear. I'd have to prepare myself for that. The hours seemed to drag by, as if they, too, had been soaked with ether. Dawn took forever. When I told her I needed to make a personal call, Greta Palmer had kindly offered the use of the telephone in the private cubicle tucked away beneath the stairs, where I would be free from prying ears. "It's on the house," she had said. "After all, we're sisters under the skin." She must have seen my puzzled look. "The Colonel's lady and Judy O'Grady are sisters under their skins," she said. "Rudyard Kipling, the sly old bird, knew more about women than he's been given credit for." "I'll leave you to it," she said as she closed the door. "I don't fancy a lot of embarrassing gush so early in the morning." I grinned, even though she was already gone. Just after sunrise, I put through a call to Bishop's Lacey. "Hello? Mrs. Mullet? It's Flavia. I hope I didn't get you out of bed." "Lord, no, Dux. I was peeling parsnips for Alf's soup before I go out." "Where are you? Is everything all right?" "Poor Alf," I thought. "His life was measured in parsnips." "Yes, thank you, Mrs. M. We're still at Volesthorpe, but we're coming home today. I thought we'd better let you know." I didn't tell her that I desperately needed to hear her voice. "It's good of you to think of me, dear. I shall peel some extra parsnips. Did you have a nice holiday?" "Quite pleasant," I said. "We viewed the church and so forth." "I missed you," she said suddenly, almost reluctantly. "Missed having you underfoot and sticking your fingers in my custard mix. I shall be glad when you're home." "Thank you, Mrs. Mullet," I managed. "So shall I. I trust you're keeping well?" "Same as always. But I have to go now, dear. My friend Mrs. Waller has a prolapsed Eucharist, and I promised I'd bring around some water biscuits for breakfast. A doctor says she needs to stay off her feet." I expressed my sympathies, we said our goodbyes, and I rang off. I waited until I could no longer stand the tension. Was there the slightest chance that Inspector Hewitt had come in early to work? There was only one way to find out. I wiped my sweating hands on my jumper and reached for the phone. "I'd like to speak with the Hindley Constabulary," I said. "Inspector Hewitt." There were various electrical clicks, hums, buzzes, and disconnects before a powerful, weary voice, which could only belong to a police sergeant, answered.
"Who shall I say is calling?" he asked.
"Flavia Deluce," I told him. And there was, at least I think there was, a fleeting silence. After what seemed like an eternity, but which must have been, in reality, no more than 20 seconds, the phone was picked up.
"Hewitt?" said that familiar voice,
that voice of which I realized I had been far too long deprived. "Inspector Hewitt," I said. "This is Flavia Deluce speaking."
"Oh, yes, Flavia. How are you?"
At least he hadn't forgotten me. "Quite well, thank you," I replied. "I should like to report a murder. No, 4 murders. Curses! I'd forgotten to ask about his wife, Antigone, and their baby."
"Where are you?" he asked.
"Volesthorpe," I told him, "at the Oak and Pheasant."
"I'm afraid that's rather off my turf, Flavia," he said. "Perhaps you should get in touch with the station there."
"I'm afraid I can't do that," I lowered my voice. "You see, I have reason to believe that the police themselves may be involved." Did I actually think that, or was my mind doing acrobatics?
"I see," the inspector said. "Tell me a bit more."
"Do you remember the Canon Whitbread affair several years ago?"
"Yes."
He was being non-committal. "He was hanged for the murder of 3 of his parishioners. Cyanide," I said.
"Yes?" he asked.
"He was innocent," I said. "He didn't do it."
"He confessed, as I recall," Inspector Hewitt pointed out. "They had no choice but to hang him, did they?"
I laughed, perhaps a little too loudly.
The inspector was pulling my leg, making a joke, and I wanted to show him it hadn't gone over my head. This little witticism was a remarkably good sign. Police inspectors do not make jokes with those they do not view as equals. At least, I hope they don't.
Begin at the beginning, and go on until you come to the end, Flavia. Then stop.
And so I did. I told the inspector how I had entangled my hand with Orlando's dead body in the river, of how Dogger and I had fished him out and laid him on the bank. I even confessed to finding the rumpled piece of paper in the dead man's pocket.
Interfering with a dead body at the scene of a crime can be a criminal offence, Flavia, he said,
not in an accusing way, but matter-of-factly, as if he were examining his fingernails.
I thought he might still be alive, I protested, rather lamely.
And you'd bring him back to life by rifling his pockets? Inspector Hewitt asked. A most novel method of artificial respiration, and one I've not heard mentioned before.
I did not tell him about my interviews with Claire Tetlock and Greta Palmer. It was not necessary. They had told me things in confidence, and I mustn't violate their trust. He would find out all he needed to know about Orlando during his own investigation. "The point is," I continued, "Canon Whitbread didn't poison those three old ladies. His son Orlando did. They had been gossiping about him. He was a paraldehyde addict. I could still smell it on his body."
"I see," Inspector Hewitt said. I pictured him making notes.
"And who killed Orlando?" he asked, as I had hoped and prayed he would.
"Nightingale, the undertaker. He tried to kill me, too. He overcame me with ether and sealed me in a coffin to die."
"Good Lord," Inspector Hewitt said, and my heart soared. "Are you all right now?"
I realized, even as I spoke, that the tears were welling up. I hadn't realized until now how close I'd come. I began to shake like a December leaf. I could hear the legs of the inspector's chair grating on his office floor.
"Stay where you are," he said. "Don't talk to anyone. Don't go outside. I shall be there as soon as I can manage."
"Thank you," I whispered.
"Oh, and Flavia?"
"Yes," I barely managed to whisper.
"Well done," he said.
Precisely 89 minutes later, I had Dogger time it with his watch. Inspector Hewitt's blue Vauxhall pulled up and parked beside the rolls in the forecourt of the Oak and Pheasant. 2 minutes later, the three of us, with me wrapped in a blanket and sipping a cup of hot OXO, faced one another across a table in the privacy of the saloon bar.
"You must tell me everything," the inspector said, "even those things you might not wish to."
I looked at Dogger. Dogger nodded solemnly, and I began to speak. It all came pouring out. Our chemical experiment with the diatoms, our visit to Skull Cottage, Poppy Mandrill, all of it, even Constable Otter.
"Constable Otter is very ambitious," I said. "He keeps insisting Orlando's death was a drowning accident. I think he's covering up, protecting someone, or himself."
"The constable was involved in the arrest and trial of Canon Whitbread, who's buried under the altar, by the way, in spite of being a convicted murderer. I don't have the means of finding out why, which is partly why I rang you up, Inspector."
"I see," he said. "But if such should prove to be the case, I must place both of you under a pledge of secrecy. This could have grave implications at the highest levels. Very grave implications."
"I promise," I said, and Dogger nodded assent. "You see, Inspector, Canon Whitbread was framed, I believe is the word you use. A number of people knowingly gave false evidence against him. One of these was Constable Otter.
a great many falsehoods were put about and allowed to spread. Orlando's train trip to London, for instance. Why? I can't begin to understand it all, but I have good reason to believe that blackmail was involved, as well as a certain amount of hanky-panky. Orlando had threatened to involve the police in certain letters he had received, which can be interpreted in more ways than one. But I must leave such delicate matters to you, Inspector. Greta chose that moment to come bustling into the room, and my heart almost stopped. I simply didn't have it in me to tell the inspector that she herself had met Orlando's train. She would need to make that, and other equine matters, part of her own confession. "Would anyone like a bite to eat?" she asked, putting her hand on my shoulder. "This little girl's looking peaky. I could have killed her."
"No, thank you, Mrs. Palmer," Dogger replied. "A quiet place to talk is all we require."
"Good old Dogger."
"Very well, then," she said, seemingly reluctant to let go of me. She drew in a great deep breath, as if coming to some decision, then said, "But when you're finished here, Inspector, I should like to have a word with you myself, in private." I gave her an encouraging smile in spite of her recent remark. I was grateful that it would be she who would explain to him that business of the brass stallion and the copper mare. When it comes to poetry, I'm way out of my depth. The inspector watched her leave, and then said,
"Tell me more about Orlando Whitbread. I assume you've compiled quite an impressive dossier on him."
Now here was a man who knew how to give credit where credit's due. I tried, by lowering my eyes, to look properly humble. I took the crumpled bit of paper and its matching mate from my jumper and placed them on the table. "This was in Orlando's pocket," I said. "The numbers refer to the Book of Timothy. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare,
and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition,"
Inspector Hewitt finished for me. With no more than a quick inspection of the paper scraps themselves, he extracted a glassine envelope from an inner pocket and slid them neatly into it.
"As you have suggested," the inspector said, "he was being blackmailed."
"Yes," I replied. "I believe he murdered the Three Graces in revenge and to silence their gossip, although I suspect his fears were greatly magnified by his use of paraldehyde."
"What makes you think that?" the inspector asked.
"Hob Nightingale saw him talking to himself on the river bank. People assumed he was rehearsing some theatrical role. But to my mind, Inspector, he was having hallucinations. Paraldehyde, especially in large quantities, has strange effects upon the human brain, of which religious visions and hallucinations are an excellent example. He might even have fancied himself to be some heavenly avenger." The inspector looked me in the eye and hauled out his biro.
"Go on," he said.
"Paraldehyde addiction may result in delirium tremens and delusions. In severe cases, it may result in complete moral deterioration." I let my words hang in the air.
"I see," Inspector Hewitt said.
"It's in medical jurisprudence. I can show it to you if you wish."
"Thank you, Flavia," he said. "I take your point. Back to your dossier," he added, almost absent-mindedly.
"Well, Orlando was an extraordinarily gifted actor," I said. "He was planning to recreate one of Poppy Mandrill's greatest stage successes, with himself in the starring role." One of Inspector Hewitt's eyebrows went slowly up, like a hawk rising on the wind.
"I see," he said.
"In some ways," I went on, "he was like a child, wanted to run away with the circus, which is why his father was so protective of him."
"To the extent of going to the gallows in his place?"
"The canon was a martyr," I said. "Someone will have to make amends."
As the inspector made another note, I glanced over at Dogger. If eyes alone could signal approval, that was the message he was sending. In spite of his addiction, Orlando had many friends. Everybody loved Orlando. Inspector Hewitt made a note.
"Just so," he said, but he obviously also had several enemies.
"The Three Graces?" I asked. "Well, yes."
"I recall the case," he said, "something of a landmark. So you believe it was Orlando who poisoned the communion wine?"
"Yes. Dogger told me that we must keep an eye out for the invisible ones. And who is more invisible than the rector's son at a vicarage? Especially one who lives scarcely a mile away in a tumble-down boathouse." Dogger was sitting with his hands folded, listening. He was leaving things to me. Orlando allowed his own father to be hanged for the crime. It was all too fatally easy. He was supposed to have been in London at the time. Inspector Hewitt said. Since then, he'd been enormously racked by guilt. So much so recently that several nights ago he returned to the very spot where he had ditched the poisoned chalice and swallowed cyanide. It was to be an act of repentance, very dramatic, in keeping with his talents. I saw a certain light come into the inspector's eyes. "Unfortunately, he was spotted," I went on. "Someone saw him and clubbed him, not realizing the poor creature had already poisoned himself." "And so," Inspector Hewitt said, "we come to Mr. Nightingale." This was the moment I had been waiting for, and I meant to relish it. "Well, you see, Inspector," I said, "when I saw that highly polished coffin in his workshop, I knew that he was in trouble. The finish was too hard. He had not conducted a funeral for a very long time, 2 years, in fact. As you know, the French polished finishes involving shellac and methylated spirits take a remarkably long time to dry, which is why they are so seldom used. Coffins tend to be required on short notice, and there's no time for fine finishes. That coffin, Inspector, had been in his workshop for simply ages. I wondered why."
"Whoa, let's back up a little," Inspector Hewitt said. "But I see what you're getting at. You believe that it was Nightingale who killed Orlando Whitbread?"
"Yes," I said.
"And his motive?"
"Money. Undertakers are the only ones who profit from every death. Mr. Nightingale has had no income since the deaths of the Three Graces 2 years ago, except, of course, for Canon Whitbread's burial, which was paid for by His Majesty's prisons, which seems suggestive in itself, don't you think?"
"That's quite a leap, Flavia," he pointed out.
"Yes," I agreed. "But I'm quite a leaper."
"I can vouch for that, Inspector."
Dogger's face gave away nothing. "Of course, the Undertaker is another of the invisible ones," I said. "No one thinks anything of it to find them in the church or the churchyard." "Oh, dear. What's going to become of poor little Hob?"
"We shall cross that bridge when we come to it," Inspector Hewitt said. "But tell me this. Did Nightingale say anything to you before his attack, before he overcame you and put you in the coffin?"
"Nothing," I told him. "I didn't even see him. He came at me out of nowhere."
"For no particular reason?" the inspector pressed. "Entirely unprovoked?"
"Except that he must have known I was on to him."
"Yes, there might be something in that," Inspector Hewitt said, closing his notebook.
"How maddening this man could be!"
"Well, then," he said, getting to his feet, "I shall have to leave you now. I have certain, inquiries to make."
Which meant arranging with the local authorities to have Nightingale, and possibly Constable Otter, clapped in irons. "Crikey!" I exclaimed, clapping my hand to my head. "Where is Mr. Nightingale?"
"I should be surprised if he's not having a nice cup of tea with Mr. Dieter and Miss Ophelia,"
Dogger answered. They offered to keep an eye on him until Inspector Hewitt arrived. I don't expect he'll give them any trouble.
When the inspector had gone, Dogger and I sat for a time in silence at the table. As an old clock ticked slowly and companionably on the mantel, I suddenly understood, really understood, the meaning of time. Dogger, I said, I want to go home.
As you wish, Miss Flavia, he said. Buckshaw is at its most convivial in the summer months.
I nodded in agreement as I allowed the dear old place to come flooding back into my consciousness for the first time in ages. The estate was now entirely mine to do with as I pleased. I could keep it, or sell it, or give it away. Aunt Felicity be blowed! There had been recent indications that all the long years of legal wrangling would soon be coming to an end. The fortunes of Buckshaw would be entering into a new age. The last pieces of the puzzle had suddenly fallen into place while I was lying only partly conscious in Nightingale's abominable coffin. Were they the remnants of a dream, a fantasy, a vision of the future? I would probably never know how inspiration came to me, but it was no less real for all that. Dogger, I said, we're going to have a brass plate made and mounted on the gates. Very discreet, of course, very tasteful. With Feely soon to be married, it made perfect sense. Of course it did. And hadn't Daffy just demonstrated her unsuspected genius at solving difficult puzzles? My heart began to hum like a spinning top as I added names to the register. Aunt Felicity, of course. Mildred Bannerman, the once convicted murderess and former teacher at Miss Bodycote's Female Academy. My old friend and would-be associate, Adam Tradescant Sowerby, the flora archaeologist. And yes, even my obnoxious little cousin Andine, whose weird enthusiasms and uncanny persistence could, in time and in the right hands, be put to good use.
"A brass plate, Miss Flavia?" Dogger asked.
"Yes," I said, drawing a rainbow in the air with my spread fingers. "And on it we shall have these words. Arthur W. Dogger and Associates. Discreet investigations."
Dogger said. "It does roll off the tongue, doesn't it, Miss Flavia? Discreet is such an elegant touch."
This is Jane Entwistle. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Graves, A Fine and Private Place by Alan Bradley. This program was directed by Kathy Thornburn. Executive Producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2018 by Alan Bradley. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.